Welcome to Family Talk with your hosts, psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, along with Ryan Dobson and Luann Crane.
Thanks for joining us here on Family Talk. I am so excited about letting our listeners hear the recording of one of the most effective speeches you've ever given, and it has never been aired before. We're calling it a warning to the Republican majority, and this is highly relevant to the national elections that have just occurred here in the United States.
Well, Ryan, we're going to devote the next 3 days to this speech because of its importance today, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Now, this is a recorded message that was delivered on February 8th, 1998, to a group of people who were concerned about public policy. And really, the only word I can think of to describe this is passionate. The second and third parts are really where the meat is, and so I hope listeners call their friends and suggest that they listen tomorrow and Wednesday particularly. They will not forget it. With all of that, Dr. Dobson, tell us briefly about this speech.
Well, thank you, Luann and Ryan, for your comments about this speech, which was given 12 years ago. I was more than a little bit irritated at that time at Republicans in Congress specifically, and you can feel that all through this presentation, but I'm going to wait until tomorrow to explain why. The first part of this speech was devoted to the moral underpinnings for my comments, and I think they're self-explanatory. Then at the end of the program today, I'll explain where I was headed, which will bring us to Tuesday's and Wednesday's program.
All right. Here now is Dr. Dobson's speech given in February of 1998.
When I have a discussion with people, there's a question that I like to ask, especially those who are theologians or pastors or those who feel like they know the Bible. It's a question that I enjoy having some fun with, and I ask them this question. I ask it of you. What is the very first thing that God created when he set out to create the universe? What was the first thing he made? When you ask people that who know the Bible, they immediately go to Genesis 1 and they try to remember what that said. And was it the heavens and the earth or the firmament or the light or the deep? What was the first thing that God created when he set out to do that? Actually, they are wrong because there's a hook in the question. The answer is not found in Genesis 1 or any part of Genesis. It's actually found in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 8. And in this passage, Proverbs 8, 22 to 30, wisdom is speaking in first person metaphorically. Wisdom is, as we know, throughout this book, God's point of view. Wisdom is his way of seeing things. Wisdom is his value system. And so wisdom here is talking about itself. And this is what it says. The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the earth or the fields or any of the dust of the world, I was there when he set the heavens in place. When he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep. When he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep. When he gave the sea its boundaries so the water would not overstep his command. And when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was the craftsman at his side. What this is saying, in other words, is that the moral law of the universe antedated the physical universe. It came first. It was not as though the children of Israel wandered into the wilderness and the Lord looks at their behavior and they're worshiping idols and they're doing all these wrong things and he says, Those folks need some rules. And so he calls Moses up into the hills and said, here are the Ten Commandments. This will help those people do better. It is not that way at all. That moral foundation, that moral law, is eternal because it's an expression of God's own nature, and it predates the universe, and it will outlast the physical laws. You can no more defy that moral law than you can jump off a 10-story building. Because if anything, the moral law outranks the physical law. The physical law is going to pass away. This book says the heavens and the earth shall be rolled up like a scroll, and there'll be a new heavens and a new earth. There'll be new physical laws, but the moral law is eternal. He said his word shall live forever. So that moral law has great significance. And it says in the end of that chapter, "For whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from the Lord. But whoever fails to find me harms himself, and all who hate me love death." The moral law of the universe. What this is saying to me, and I hope to you, is that the universe has a boss. It has a boss. And he has very clear ideas of what is right and what is wrong. It doesn't matter a whole lot what you think or what I think. What matters is what he thinks. Because that moral law has been there from eternity and will be there to eternity. And if that is true, then we have an obligation to understand it and to respect it. Now, I'm not talking today about dogma. I'm not talking about denominations. I'm not talking about churches. I'm talking about a law that's written on the heart of every human being. And this is the end of the Sunday school lesson. Romans 2:14 says, I'm going to paraphrase this. It says, when the Gentiles, the non-Jews, act in accordance with the law, having not heard the law, it shows that they have a law in themselves written on their hearts, for their consciences either condemn or approve their behavior. Now, you can override that law, and you can sear that conscience, and you can get beyond it, but it is there. It is there in all of us. It is programmed into the human spirit. You do not have to be taught that it is wrong to murder. You don't have to be taught that it's wrong to steal and to lie and to extort and to bribe and to oppress the poor and to express racial hatred and to be promiscuous, both homosexually and heterosexually. There's no difference between those two. Promiscuity is immoral. It's wrong, as is adultery. That law is eternal, and it is written on the heart of man. Now, the world doesn't accept that view. I want to tell you, that understanding that I just gave you, and forgive me for kind of being in a didactic mode, but that understanding provides the basis for my whole life, my whole worldview, my understanding of where we are as a nation and what's going on in Washington and all the state houses of government. That's the foundation. But as you know, there are many people that don't accept it today. We have already heard from David Noble and others who talked about other worldviews, primarily postmodernism. Postmodernism essentially rejects that explanation I just gave you. Postmodernism says there is no God, and there is no eternal standard. There are no rules. You make them up as you go along. What seems right is right. There are no transcendent values that will stand from time to time. When human life becomes inconvenient, you can get rid of it because it was not created by God, because there is no God. And it's all subjective and whimsical, and you make up your ideas as the circumstances arise. And that postmodern notion that there is no moral law to the universe has taken hold and taken root like a cancer that spread through this entire nation. And it continues to spread. MTV works on it every single day.
You're listening to Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson, and we're about halfway through a very important speech that Dr. Dobson gave in February of 1998. It obviously has enormous implications here in 2010, immediately following our recent midterm elections. We hope you can stay with us for the entire message, as we'll be providing more context for this later on. If not, just go to myfamilytalk.com, where you can download, podcast, or even stream the entire message. Let's return now to Dr. Dobson's speech.
John Leo is a columnist for Newsweek. I'm sure many of you read his stuff, and he comes up with some very interesting columns. And he had one in there, I think, about 6 or 8 months ago that just blew me away. He was reflecting conversations with history professors on university campuses about this issue, about moral relativism. And they told him that it is very common today for the students, of course, to accept no right and wrong, no standard whatsoever. There is no absolute truth, which gets you into some very interesting positions. One of them dealing with the Nazis in World War II. And he said it's common for students to say, well, I don't particularly happen to have liked the Nazis. I dislike what they did. But who's to say that it was morally wrong to gas Jews? See, if there's no moral truth, if there is no standard, then there is no horrible atrocities and holocausts that can be condemned. So that those images that we've seen of 1,000 people, women and children, standing naked in the rain all day, holding a little baby, with little children frightened around their knees for their turn to go into a gas chamber, is not morally wrong. Who's to say? The silly, unfortunate, misled kids saying, who's to say it was morally wrong? Because there is no moral standard. It changes absolutely everything. You probably are aware of the article in the New York Times by Dr. Steven Pinker, a evolutionary psychologist, so to speak, who wrote in November or late October in the New York Times, of all places, about the rationale for mothers killing their newborns. See, Francis Schaeffer told us in 1970 that abortion and infanticide and euthanasia were all connected. And you allow one and you'll have all three, because they all deal with the sanctity of life. Who made life? If God is eliminated, and therefore you can eliminate the unborn child, you will soon be eliminating not only infants that you don't want and older people you don't want, but all undesirables. And he told us this was coming, and here it comes. And Steven Pinker writes this article in which he's just carefully laying down the philosophical foundations, the way the left works. You know, they'll just put it out there, and then they'll let everybody gasp, and then somebody else goes a little farther. Well, I don't know if you saw the article on November 6th, right after that, in the Washington Post. This one really took my breath away. It is referring to a Dr. Michael Tooley. Dr. Tooley is a philosophy professor at the University of Colorado, and he is what he calls a eugenicist, and that gives you a clue. And he says, and Tooley does not bother with Pinker's pretense that what's under discussion here is only a rare act of desperation, the killing of an unwanted child by a frightened, troubled mother. No, no, no. If it is moral to kill a baby for one, it is moral for all. Indeed, the systematic, professionalized use of infanticide would be a great benefit to humanity. Most people would prefer to raise children who do not suffer from gross deformities or from severe physical, emotional, or intellectual handicaps, writes eugenicist Tooley. Get this last sentence. If it could be shown that there is no moral objection to infanticide, Why would there be no moral objection to infanticide? Because there's no moral objection to anything. It's all subjective. The happiness of society could be significantly and justifiably increased. And here it comes. So there is that perspective, and where it leads is to the dehumanization of undesirables, and we know where that led in 1938 and after in Nazi Germany. Now, obviously, not everyone accepts this notion. And I'm here to talk to you today about those who don't. I want to encourage you and tell you what you already know, that there are millions and millions and millions and millions of people in this country who do honor the holy. Pardon me. The Holy One of Israel, and have not bowed at the feet of Baal. There are millions of them out there. And I want to tell you about them. They're good people. Good people. They love their kids. They love their spouses, their families. They love their God. And they are very, very concerned about what's happening today. They see this moral free fall. They see this moral relativism, and they're very concerned about it. It contradicts everything they stand for. And they also feel under attack. They feel under assault by Hollywood, and they can't do anything about it. And by the rock music industry that just sells sex and violence and all sorts of evil to their kids. And they see the television and cable TV and MTV and all those sorts of things. They see it, and they're very alarmed about it. And they can't do anything about it. They feel the culture has got their families. The culture is like a river that flows in front of us. And their kids are caught in this river, and they're being carried downstream. And so many of them are being wounded by it. They're beginning to believe the things that they're told. Those people are very concerned. There was a poll that was taken just in the last couple of months by the Luntz Research Organization that showed 80% of the American people, 80%, believe that we're in a severe moral crisis. That's not 80% of conservatives like us. It's 80% of the nation says we're in a moral crisis. The Pew Research Organization last April asked people to list their concerns. What bothers them the most? What worries them the most? And at the top of the list, above everything else, was a decline in moral values. These people out there are worried about what they see. And they're in contradiction with the elites and with the cultural trend setters. And it is very difficult for any of us to get anyone in government to understand those people or to treat them like they had a legitimate point of view. And that is my concern. I'm going to go back to 1995, when I was here last, and to something I was trying to say at that time that I never got a chance to finish. I was trying to tell a story about a visit that I had with Senator Phil Graham. I want to share it with you now, not to attack him or embarrass him, but simply to convey what I'm trying to say. In 1995, I was looking for a politician, a Republican leader who had a chance to win the White House, who understood what I've been saying, who understood that moral foundation to the universe, who was willing to articulate it and willing to fight for it. And I decided that Phil Graham just might be that man. I heard him on TV. I liked what he said. I thought that maybe he might be the one that we could get excited about. And so I asked for an appointment to see him, and he agreed to see me. And I flew to Washington, D.C. from Colorado Springs. And with me that day were Gary Bauer, Ralph Reed, and Betsy DeVos. Went in to see him. Went in and sat down. I had this on my heart. I have something I really want to say. And he starts by telling us that he only has 40 minutes. He has to go to something. And he begins talking. And he talked, and he talked, and he talked for 30 minutes, and we got 10 minutes left. And he's still talking. And so I finally said, Senator, it's not polite to interrupt a senator when he's talking, but I came a long way to say something to you, and if you don't ever let me say it, I'll leave here, and you won't ever know what I came to say. So he talked some more, and then he said, okay, what is it that you came to say? I said, Senator, there are millions and millions and millions of people out there, good family people, trying to raise their kids, trying to keep them moral, trying to teach them what they believe, that are very agitated and very concerned because they don't hear anybody echoing what they believe. And they're not known to the New York Times. They're not represented by the New York Times. And they're not known inside the Beltway. People don't talk about those folks inside the Beltway. It's as though they don't exist. Or if they do, they're called names like Hillary Clinton called them last week. And they said they're not known to the Washington Post, who referred to them as poor, uneducated, and easy to control. That's the attitude. I said, Senator, if you would hone in on those people and speak their language and talk to their hearts and identify with the things they care about instead of just talking about taxes and economy and money, they care about more than money. If you will do this, you will have millions of people following you. I never forget what he said. It's been widely quoted in the paper. It's been misquoted in the paper. Some people say that he said, I ain't no preacher and I can't do that. That's not what he said. Some people have said that he said, I'm not running for preacher and I can't do that. That's not what he said. What he actually said was, I'm not a preacher and I can't do that. And I said, Senator, you will never reach our people. And we got up and left. And Senator Graham was out of the race in Louisiana just a few weeks later.
That was my dad, Dr. James Dobson, speaking 12 years ago to a large assembly of people concerned about public policy and more specifically about the failure of Republicans to fulfill their promises made to the American people back in 1994. Dad, that was powerful.
Well, there are times when a speaker is on fire and you ain't heard nothing yet because you can hear where I'm going.
Absolutely.
In the next 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
We will put flesh on those bones.
Sure. And in a way, is this not a warning to the newly elected officials to not abandon their base?
Well, Ryan, that's why we're airing it, because this does represent something of a warning to the new Republican majority.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's happened before.
That's right.
They've been there before. 1994, they suddenly found themselves in the majority. No one predicted it, and there they were. You and I were on a hunting trip
mm-hmm.
On that occasion, and we'd come in from hunting, and Ed Prince, my great friend who's gone on to be with the Lord, and I sat there till 1:30 in the morning watching it happen as just out of nowhere, the Republicans had won this huge victory.
That's right.
And they did it by promising some things to the American people and immediately set out to abandon them.
That's right.
And that's what we're going to be talking about in the next 2 days.
They immediately started talking about bipartisanship, reaching across the aisle, building bridges. I have to be honest, I never elect somebody to be bipartisan. I elect someone to be conservative. I do not elect anybody to reach across an aisle. I elect them to be conservative.
And you expect them to tell the truth
yeah.
about what their values are.
That's exactly right.
And we have not seen anything yet that would indicate the Republicans are about to lie to us.
Sure.
So this is preemptive, but that's where we're going because this is history repeating itself.
Well, as Yogi Berra said, it is deja vu all over again, Doctor.
And we're out of time, Luann. I just want to urge our listeners to be here tomorrow and Wednesday mm-hmm. Because it's very frustrating to me to have to cut a continuing message in thirds, as we've done now, because of time. And I hope that our listeners will be back with us next time.
I sure do, too. And in the meantime, if you're motivated to find out what's going on Capitol Hill, we have links to several outstanding organizations which track all of the issues there, especially those that affect your family. All of that's available at myfamilytalk.com. Of course, you can always count on us here on the broadcast to keep you informed of major events that are happening in Washington. If an issue pops up, we will talk about it right here. We are listener supported. If you would like to stand with us in addressing these issues, would you consider a donation to this ministry? You can donate online. Just click the donate tab at myfamilytalk.com or give us a call, 877-732-6825, 877-732-6825. Thanks for joining us, and do not miss tomorrow as we continue this message.